Welcome to episode 86 of Primary Care Update. I'm Dr. Mark A. Bell, family physician and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
I'm Kate Rowland, family physician and associate professor at Rush University.
I'm John Hickner, also a family physician and editor-in-chief of the Journal of Family Practice.
Returns the prodigal son.
Yes, good to be back.
Thank you. Thank you. Welcome back, John. I'm Henry Barry, a family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPoems. Last week, I received a notice from my medical school alumni association about my 40th medical school class reunion. And I'd like to just give a shout out to two of my classmates. One is Phil Hall. He and I both fulfilled our National Health Service Corps commitments near Charleston, West Virginia, back in the 80s. Now, Phil owned his own practice, and as a result, and as a reflection of how poor our primary care infrastructure is, the poor guy had to moonlight at an urgent care in order to be able to feed his family because he couldn't make ends meet his expenses in his private practice. He eventually moved to Altoona, Pennsylvania, where he took care of pretty much everybody in the community, including the local sports teams. Unfortunately, Phil died suddenly last week, and my heart goes out to Paula and the kids. My second classmate is Don Richter. Don and I rotated together on many clinical rotations, which gave me great faith that when my parents moved close to him, where he grew up in Accident, Maryland, that's a great town, and he cared for my parents for probably most of two decades. And just earlier this year, the Maryland Academy of Family Physicians gave Don a Lifetime Achievement Award. So congratulations, Don.
Thanks, Henry. So we are four Midwestern family docs who on this podcast tell you about studies that have the potential to change your practice. We call them poems. If you want all of them, go to essentialevidenceplus.com where you get a poem every day, plus a primary care reference with over 800 chapters and thousands of interactive decision support tools, essentialevidenceplus.com. And for any lawyers who may be listening, the opinions expressed on Primary Care Update are those of the commentators. And this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. This week, we're going to discuss dexamethasone after major non-cardiac surgery, topical terbinafine for onychomycosis, thromboprophylaxis during knee replacement, and mRNA COVID vaccine adverse events. Kate, why don't you take it away?
I would love to. So I'm going to talk today about a study out of the BMJ by Asanue and colleagues. And this study sought to answer the question, does post-operative high-dose dexamethasone decrease mortality or complications in patients who are undergoing major non-cardiac surgery? You might reasonably ask why anyone would think that it might. So low-dose steroids are used, presumably safely, in the perioperative setting to prevent nausea and vomiting. And we use short-term bursts of steroids for a number of anti-inflammatory indications, although there is pretty good evidence that even a short-term burst is associated with significant complications. So in this study conducted in France, the authors hypothesized that administering high-dose steroids following major non-cardiac surgeries could reduce the local and systemic inflammation that was induced by the surgery itself, and that in turn would reduce post-op complications. So patients in this study were randomized to receive either dexamethasone 0.2 mg per kg for a max dose of 20 milligrams or a matching placebo as an IV bolus immediately after surgery and then another dose on the post-op day one. Two groups were equal at baseline. Abdominal surgery was the most common surgery type. The primary outcome was a composite of typical post-op complications, sepsis, pneumonia, or the need for either invasive or non-invasive mechanical ventilation. And all-cause mortality, all-cause mortality 14 days after surgery. What they found was that there was no significant difference between the two groups in that composite outcome. They were looking at about 17% in the dexamethasone group and 19, pushing 20% in the placebo group. That gave them an adjusted odds ratio that turned out to have neither a significant p-value nor a particularly impressive confidence interval. So they looked at a bunch of different subgroups. They broke down their data in a couple of different ways. And when they looked at only the group of patients who had non-thoracic surgery, the dexamethasone group did look a little bit better, but only barely. I do want to note that the upper limit of the confidence interval got them to 0.99. That was for an adjusted odds ratio of 0.7. there was no difference in mortality, pneumonia, or sepsis, but the dexamethasone, when they broke out that composite outcome, but the dexamethasone group had a lower rate of mechanical ventilation. It is important to note that the investigators had expected about a 20% overall complication rate in the placebo group and about a 14% in the dexamethasone group, and they found overall a lower rate. So it's possible that that the study power may have been too small to detect a difference in primary outcome, if one did in fact exist. So finally, and this is the most important thing that I'll say about this study, it is important to note that this study was completed by the perioperative administration of corticotherapy on morbidity and mortality after non-cardiac surgery. So thanks to selective capitalization, they called themselves the Pac-Man group.
I love
Henry,
it.
I felt
another
like
great acronym.
You particularly would appreciate that. But any other comments on whether we should start doing this?
I will. So I think the first and most important point to make is that this was a negative study, period. Second is that we have to be really cautious when folks play up subgroup analyses. The more subgroup analyses you do, the greater their likelihood is that you will find some association that looks beneficial by chance. So we shouldn't put our eggs in that basket. We should treat these subgroup analyses as hypothesis-generating exercises that need further assessment. My last point is that this was a single study, and back in the early 2000s, there was a single study of bisoprolol administered perioperatively to high-risk patients that showed an improvement in perioperative complications, and perioperative beta blockers became all the rage until we started seeing accumulation of data that suggested, well, maybe not only were they not so much beneficial, but maybe we started to see more harms. And so selective publication early on becomes a real critical consideration.
Hey, John, what do you think?
The decision to do this, of course, is likely to be the surgeon. And so I think we'll just wait and see if surgeons hop on board, if this is real. And as Henry says, it's hypothesis generation. If it's real, the NNT looks like about 1 in 20 to prevent probably one case of mechanical ventilation. So the payoff is not large, but the cost is not large. So let's wait and see if we get more research along this line.
Yeah, when they do so many subgroup analyses like this, you got to think of it as, you know, if they had 10 analyses, it's like doing 10 different studies. And if one of them by chance shows a benefit, we wouldn't be getting that excited if there were 9 negative trials, you know. And so I think that's one way to look at this, is that the hypothesis generating, let's see another study and let's not jump on board. Yeah, surgeons do have a way of, I remember when I get consulted on, you know, I'd get consulted to do the pre-op evaluation, and I'd write thromboprophylaxis orders for an orthopedic surgeon, and he would line them out because they didn't want the bleeding in their precious field. So the clots aren't their problem, I guess. Anyway, Kate, you're going to tell us about the quiz.
I sure am. We're going to change gears a little bit here. The question is, which of the following is the best treatment for asymptomatic rectal chlamydia? Is it A, doxycycline 100 milligrams BID for 7 days? B, doxycycline 100 milligrams BID for 14 days? C, azithromycin 1 gram once? Or D, azithromycin 1 gram in 2 doses 24 hours apart? Stay tuned.
Good question. All right. Hey, before I turn it over to Henry, I want to remind listeners you can get CME credit from the Illinois Academy of Family Physicians. For listening to this podcast, just go to IAFP.com, click on the online IAFP education webpage button, and find our podcast. Henry, tell us about terbinafine.
Thank you. This study asks the question, is topical terbinafine 10% solution effective for the treatment of mild to moderate subungual onychomycosis? This was by Gupta and colleagues in the Journal of the American Academy of Dermatology in the July issue. This was an industry-sponsored randomized trial where they took patients aged 12 to 74 years of age who had culture-confirmed ugly-looking toenails. The nail had to involve 20 to 60% of at least one toenail. And they excluded them if you look at the very base of the nail, if there was nearly total involvement of that nail, or if the nail was more than 3 millimeters thick. They excluded those individuals. So they screened nearly 1,900 individuals. More than 80% failed the initial screen. So this is a highly selective group of individuals. And they didn't say much about the screening procedures. My suspicion is it was some combination of clinical characteristics and nail characteristics, but maybe some concerns about their ability to complete the study. So that left just about 365 individuals who were randomly assigned to either apply this topical solution to the nail itself and under the free edge or to the vehicle itself. And then they did this for 48 weeks once a day. And they had pretty high levels of follow-up. 93% of the participants were evaluated a year later. And they were evaluated by people who did not know what the original treatment was. And they used an outcome of having 0% clinical disease, meaning that the nail looked perfectly normal and had negative scraping for KOH and negative fungal culture. So a fairly rigorous standard. A lot of patients would probably have been satisfied just with the clinical cure alone. So that overall cure only occurred in about 4.5% of those treated with terbinafine and nobody in the placebo-treated patients. So what that translates to is about a number needed to treat of about 1 in 20, which is not really great. And you know, I went back and I found that in the Cochrane Systematic Review in 2017, they found that oral terbinafine was more effective than placebo with a number needed to treat to achieve a cure of about 4. And they also found in that study, though, no significant difference in adverse event rates, even though it was infrequently communicated. And that's the main argument for using a topical agent is that clinicians are concerned about toxicity, drug-drug interactions, things of that nature, and maybe those are slightly overblown. Oral terbinafine average cost is about $50, but on goodrx.com, I found it as low as $9. I don't think that the 10% solution is available in the U.S. yet because I couldn't find any information about pricing or FDA approval. So for me, the really big question is how much trouble does mild to moderate toenail fungus cause other than embarrassment? Isn't that what shoes and socks were made to prevent? After all, they're just ugly looking toenails. And so this to me seems like a study. We talk about poems and does. I think this is prose, profit-oriented suspicious evidence.
Oh, that's good, Henry.
These topicals like Cycloperox just don't seem to work very well. I mean, 5% response rate, you know, that's terrible. So, yeah, that's not going to work out. So, yeah, I just edited a chapter for American Family Physician on onychomycosis, and terbinafine orally is the preferred therapy. So I think I agree with Henry. That's the way to go for now. Kate?
It must be amazing for you all to go through life like having the option to always wear closed-toed shoes.
That's amazing. Yeah,
I have no frame of reference for what it's like to always have that option. So I think I have like a little more empathy for people who are like the need to occasionally show their feet like in social situations that, you know, we're required to wear closed-toe shoes at work. But sometimes you just like, I don't know, you get invited to a beach wedding or something and you're sort of stuck with some kind of open-toed shoe. And there are situations where maybe you don't want the world seeing your weird toenail fungus. So I don't know. I can sort of see I've got, again, a little bit different perspective on why this may not quite be as spurious.
I agree with you, Kate. I agree with you, Kate. And I think, you know, if someone does want to treat it, we have reasonably effective treatments. And some folks also use Diflucan, although that's off-label. And given once weekly for 6 months was another option in one study. So there are options. This just isn't one of them, I'm afraid. And so I'm going to talk about one of these names, abelacimab. I'm going to say abelacimab, we're going to call it, which is a monoclonal antibody. that is designed as it is an inactivates factor 11. The authors randomized 412 adults who were undergoing knee replacement to either 30 milligrams, 75 milligrams, or 150 milligrams of this drug once, 4 to 8 hours postoperatively, or to enoxaparin, the standard therapy, 40 milligrams once daily for 8 to 12 days. This was a typical group. It was actually largely women, 80% women, 90% underwent spinal anesthesia, and the average time until ambulation was about a day after surgery. The main efficacy outcome was whether the patient developed a symptomatic whether a blood clot was seen on a venogram. And this is key. The primary efficacy outcome was any clot seen on a venogram that everybody got 10 days later, or symptomatic episode of thromboembolism. The main safety outcome was any non-major bleeding through day 30. The vast majority of patients completed the study. They are the main thing that they are proudly telling us about is that the number of episodes of thromboembolism were significantly lower with the 75 and 150 milligram doses, 5 and 4 episodes versus 22 in the enoxaparin group, which is statistically significant. And it might be clinically significant, except most of these were distal clots. And I think we really have to be careful to distinguish a distal DVT, which the guidelines actually say we don't always have to treat, and symptomatic from asymptomatic. Most of these were asymptomatic. People never would have known about them had they not been forced to have a venogram. In the whole population, there was only one symptomatic DVT. That was in the enoxaparin group. There were only 3 proximal DVTs, one in one of the abelacimab groups and 2 in the enoxaparin. The rest of the clots were asymptomatic distal DVTs, never would have been detected, likely never would have caused a problem. With regards to safety, there were no episodes of major bleeding in any group, and only 4 episodes of clinically relevant non-major bleeding. They were all actually in the abelacimab groups. Abelacimab, that kind of rolls off the tongue. So abelacimab may provide better protection against clinically irrelevant asymptomatic distal clots. Otherwise, really doesn't seem to appear to offer any advantage over enoxaparin. That's my skeptical take for the day. John, you want to chime in?
I don't think that's skeptical. I think your interpretation is correct. And there's no question in my mind that this is a negative trial.
And Kate?
I'll jump on that and say that their comparator is also a little unusual for me, that we don't typically use, at least where I practice, we don't use Lovenox as our sort of standard of care. We'll use rivaroxaban or another DOAC typically immediately post-op for a knee replacement. So that's another reason to sort of think like, is this really, enough to start using something new when it comes to market?
Yeah, and you know that a monoclonal antibody ain't going to be cheap, right?
I do know that.
It's probably a couple $1,000 for the dose that they get. So, anyway, that's. I don't think this one's going anywhere. It was in the New England Journal of Pharmaceutical Trials, so it'll get some press. But I think we need to be pretty skeptical of the value of this. And again, that's just for listeners. It's always important when we're looking at studies of thromboprophylaxis. It's important to ask, were they symptomatic clots or were they asymptomatic clots that we never would have known about otherwise? Same thing with studies of osteoporosis. Was it an asymptomatic or a symptomatic vertebral fracture, that kind of thing? So, we have to always be asking those questions. John has John, you're going to kill us. Double header, 2 studies, but he promises to be quick and tell us these things very quickly.
This will be the fastest double header ever.
All right.
These are about vaccine side effects. The first study being from Israel and took a look at side effects or adverse events from the Pfizer-BioNTech. The study used a large health system database to compare adverse events between vaccinated and a matched group of unvaccinated individuals, so a very straightforward comparison. The comparison used the Kaplan-Meier method and assessed events for up to 42 days after vaccination to catch everything. They also looked at the adverse events in patients who had recent COVID infection and compared that to uninfected persons as kind of a background comparison. In the vaccination analysis, the vaccinated and control groups each had just short of a million persons in it, so a fairly large study. And vaccination was associated with elevated risk of a few things, not a lot, but myocarditis with an additional 2.1 events per 100,000 persons, lymphadenopathy, I'm not sure that's all that important, appendicitis was slightly elevated as well as the risk of herpes zoster infection with a risk difference of 15.8 events per 100,000 persons. But if you look at SARS-CoV-2 infection, there was a substantially increased risk of myocarditis with a risk ratio of 18, quite high. That's 11 events per 100,000 patients. And also other serious events had elevated risk with SARS-CoV infection, that is pericarditis, arrhythmia, DVT, PE, MI, intracranial hemorrhage, and thrombocytopenia. By the way, in this study, there was an elevated risk of myocarditis only, and this was a 1 to 5 events per 100,000. So that was the main finding from this study. Now, I know that's not new, but it is a good population-based study that confirms some of the other surveillance data that we've seen from the CDC. And this next adverse event study is interesting because of the novel comparison that they made. This again is the mRNA vaccine, both the Pfizer and the Moderna. And this study used the Vaccine Safety Data Link, which includes about 10 million vaccine eligible members of 8 U.S. health plans. The novel comparison was that they compared adverse events that occurred 1 to 21 days after vaccination with adverse events that occurred also in vaccinated individuals 22 to 42 days after vaccination. So both groups were vaccinated. Since the vaccine adverse events are highly unlikely to occur after 3 weeks, though they contend, the authors say that this is a valid comparison. So it's an interesting comparison that one, I suppose, could argue with. A very comprehensive, large study, they looked at 23 adverse events, which were ascertained from emergency department records, mostly in hospital records from these healthcare systems. And they looked at a bunch that, as I say, 23 including MI, Bell palsy, central cerebral venous sinus thrombosis, Guillain-Barré, et cetera. So they looked at just about everything. During the study, there were about 12 million doses of mRNA vaccine administered to 6.2 million individuals. And here are a few of the comparisons. And by the way, all the comparisons are negative. And they were looking at the incidence of events per 1 million person years. So if we look at ischemic stroke, 1,612 versus 1,781, the adjusted risk ratio is then 0.97. For appendicitis, adjusted risk ratio of 0.82, acute MI, adjusted risk ratio of 1.02, and for myocarditis, pericarditis, there was a slightly elevated risk ratio of 1.18, but there was no statistical difference between that. So the bottom line was that none of these 23 vaccine outcome associations met the pre-specified requirement for an adverse event signal from vaccine administration. By the way, the incidence of confirmed anaphylaxis was pretty much identical with what we've seen from the other studies, around 5 events per 100,000 individuals. So again, there have been a lot of studies of vaccine adverse events, and what's emerged primarily is this myocarditis, pericarditis, which occurs almost exclusively in young men. And this does not address, of course, the venous thromboembolism seen primarily with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. But I think these studies are all important because the data is accumulating more and more that these vaccines are quite safe, and we still have a lot of vaccine holdout patients. So it's important to get this data out in a way that people can understand that, yes, there are some vaccine adverse events, but they're really very rare and nowhere near as dangerous as getting COVID itself.
Yeah, and I think it's important to point out also that the myocarditis, while it does appear to be a real association and it is incredibly rare, it also is self-limited. This, you know, yes, it tends to get better over a period of weeks with as far as we know, no real residual damage. So, you know, that's another important thing. This is not something that affects someone, we think, the rest of their life. Henry, any thoughts?
Yeah, so I think, John, your bottom line is one I agree with, that these data, the compilation of all of the data, confirm that these vaccines, like many other vaccines that we have, not necessarily COVID, the adverse event rates are low and certainly much lower than natural disease. Now, I would not be internally consistent if I didn't point out that these are what were reported in a relatively passive kind of a system, which is not necessarily the same thing as explicitly evaluating certain things. So we will never know the actual event rates of things unless we ask about things such as magnetism, chip implant complications, and zombie or cyborg transformation.
Just a slight correction, Henry. These were not reported events. These were events determined through chart review in these healthcare systems. So I think it makes the data a little bit better than the CDC vaccine event reporting system.
Well, again, though, in it's what clinicians are doing. So unless you specifically ask, sure, you won't know.
Yeah. So you can't detect illness that people don't get seen in the healthcare system for. Good point.
Clear this up for us.
I was going to change the subject, actually. I just wanted to add that I read a letter, actually, in the New England Journal last week about from some CDC researchers, just to add to the list of things that the vaccine does not appear to be associated with, looking at the risk of miscarriage in people who had in early stages up to 14 weeks of pregnancy, and found no incidence, even when they sort of made some worst case scenario assumptions. So just to lend to the sort of safety profile of the vaccine, especially in early pregnancy, because we know that there's an increased risk of complications in pregnant women who and pregnant people who contract COVID.
Good. And I don't know how closely you guys follow social media, but Dr. Nicki Minaj reported that it causes orchitis, which it does not. There are lots of things that do cause orchitis that her cousin in Trinidad may have been doing or having, but that wasn't one of them. So anyway, Kate, you're going to give us a quiz answer.
I am. Right. So the question again was, which of the following is the best treatment for asymptomatic rectal chlamydia? Is it doxy 100 BID for 7 days, doxy 100 BID for 14 days, azithromycin 1 gram once, or azithromycin 1 gram in 2 doses 24 hours apart? So the answer here is doxycycline 100 milligrams BID for 7 days. And I will say this question is just a little bit misleading because not all of these treatment regimens were included in this study that I'm about to talk about. So 625 asymptomatic men with a positive screening test for chlamydia, they were randomized to either 100 milligrams of doxy twice a day for 7 days or 1 gram of azithromycin once, both pretty standard treatments for chlamydia. The primary outcome was a negative nucleic acid amplification test at study week 4, so 4 weeks after treatment. This was significantly more likely in the intention to treat analysis for those who got the doxy. Risk difference was about 20%. Then, so that gives us a number needed to treat of about 5. I always love it when researchers do this. They thought because there's a very different side effect profile, they asked the participants to guess what they thought they had taken, basically to assess how good their blinding was. But there was no difference between groups in the percentage of correct guesses. Adverse events were actually less likely in the doxycycline group. The main difference was in fewer cases of diarrhea in the doxy group. It is worth noting that screening for rectal chlamydia is recommended in men who have sex with men, as it's asymptomatic about 85% of the time. That is the quiz for today.
Thanks, Kate. Appreciate that. And my dog Gunner just decided to bark at the mailman. Oh, Gunner, stop it. Here's the URL if you want to go to get some CME credit, IAFP.com. Click on online IAFP education. The Illinois Academy of Family Physicians is accredited by the ACCME to give you CME credit for listening to our podcast. They designate it for a half AMA Category 1 credit. The IAFP adheres to the conflict of interest policy of the ACCME and the AMA. You can read the complete disclosure at their website. Thanks for joining us today. Hope you enjoyed our discussion. Tell your friends. Rate us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and we'll be with you next week for more primary care updates.